Mike, last month we reviewed some of the inspiring victories in local elections around the country, from decriminalization of drug possession to progressive prosecutors winning in various cities. The national system of courts is another world, with their elaborate network of benches and remote places with extensive adjudicating powers. So let's start today with the Supreme Court in the post-Trump era, and then federal district courts, and your assessment of the potential impact of all of these courts and their shift to the far right. The Supreme Court is the highest level of the federal court system. There are courts of appeals, the VA courts, the tax courts, and an elaborate web of federal district courts across the country. What's critical about these conservative appointments to federal courts under Trump, perhaps starting with the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court, for the people who are listening to this show, it's not your friend. There was a brief moment in the long history of this country where it was, in the 1960s and 70s. The court has, for most all of its history, been extraordinarily anti-democratic. It's been relied on by reactionary forces. And now we have a court that has rejoined the completely reactionary court that gutted all the efforts after the Civil War to eliminate white supremacy. We have a court now, I think religion will be the new theme. Their constitution is very brief about religion. It says you can't pass a law that would either require it or prohibit it.
With the New York ruling, with the pandemic restrictions and the health advisories that restricted churches from meeting, with Amy Coney Barrett on the court, a ruling that was made as recently as a few months ago seems to have been reversed. Is that a harbinger of things to come?
Most definitely. We will hear the word religion and the concept religion quite a bit in the future. The court has decided to replace the views of epidemiologists with its own views of what might infringe on the practice of religion. And if you think about what religious activity is, it's possible to have almost any part of law, certainly any part of our health system, public health or private health, and other parts of law, including private property for that matter, all sorts of rules and administrative regulations can be said to have some incidental effect on religion. And that has, until now, been accepted. But now we're having, with cases involving the Hobby Lobby and requirements of what women workers are allowed to get as in their health plans, to group assemblies, what's allowed now and who's allowed to determine it, are being limited by the court on grounds that it impinges on religious freedom.
Well, the Supreme Court also takes a tiny fraction of the thousands of appeals submitted to their court, and chief justices don't have to issue a reason or rationale for what they take up and what they don't. Why the power of this court, given their latitude, what they take up, what they don't, and most of the cases before it, they refuse anyway?
Well, the court does take very few cases, but what it can do and what it has done is strike down federal legislation. It was extended that power by a legislature a long time ago, but it has the power, for example, to strike down the Affordable Care Act. It had the power in the 1870s and 1880s to strike down federal laws aimed at protecting Black people. In one case called U.S. v. Cruikshank, several people in Louisiana were tried and convicted during the Colfax massacre. There was a dispute over the governorship in Louisiana and a riot that led to more than 100 Black people being killed. They were tried and convicted, and this U.S. Supreme Court said essentially it reversed their convictions and said this is a matter for the states to tend to. It essentially abandoned Black people and endorsed lynching. It got rid of any and all laws aimed at discrimination, therefore allowing the South to discriminate in every way in private lodgings, and it enabled them to limit the right to vote. It enabled Black people to be criminally abused without any oversight from the federal government. I mean, there were remarkably bright and diligent and smart people as part of the Republicans in the wake of the Civil War and the laws they passed, including the 14th Amendment. But the 14th Amendment was eviscerated until the mid-20th century, when an opinion by William Douglas really resuscitated the civil rights law, what we know as Section 1983, and other parts of the Bills of Rights were made applicable to the states. And very slowly, much of those laws were resuscitated by the Warren Court. But it was a large step backwards from Thurgood Marshall to Clarence Thomas. It was another large step backwards from Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Amy Coney Barrett. And we are in the place now where we're reduced to examining Brett Kavanaugh's childhood misdemeanors. We have somehow unwittingly, by supporting the Supreme Court as a result of the great decisions it made in the 60s, essentially, we've turned over so much power to the juristocracy. They not only are allowed to rule on sweeping federal legislation that could have been the result of years of committees and hearings, but they can invalidate state laws. They can overturn anything that is a product of democratically elected people.
What might be a strategy for defanging or reducing the power of the Supreme Court?
One way would be to extend their numbers by having new people appointed, creating a different ideological balance. Another way would be to weaken their powers. I mean, it can be a matter of legislation to say that any decision by the Supreme Court that's going to strike down federal legislation would require a unanimous vote or require at least 8 votes. That would have profound effect because it would mean that only those laws that were so blatantly against the Constitution could be struck down. Anything where there's a 5-4 split is essentially an ideological verdict, one way or the other. That would not be allowed to invalidate sweeping general legislation like the Social Security system or healthcare systems. Those kind of systems would be immune unless they were completely bad. There are other ways of reducing the power. And I think for us, we need to focus our energies on the democratic process and recognize now the court is not our friend. It's anti-democratic in intention. Ideally, it would support insular minorities like African Americans who are never going to be a majority and keep them from the tyranny of majorities. And that was one of its virtues, or so we thought, in the 60s and 70s. Even when you look at the good things the Supreme Court has done,
like the Brown versus the Board of Education is often cited.
Right. There was a brief period when there were good decisions made, but Brown really didn't have any effect until it was enabled by federal legislation later. And one could argue now that segregation is every bit as virulent as it ever has been. The same true with feminism. I mean, women have done quite well in Western Europe and other places without some sweeping, overarching gift from a small number of juristocrats. It's true that in this country, there would be places where abortions would be very hard to get.
And already are very hard to get.
You know as well as anybody that places in the South, for example, that are generally opposed to abortion have made it unbelievably difficult and essentially required women who want an abortion to go somewhere else.
Yeah, and next month, let's return to Roe v. Wade and the terrain ahead for abortion rights. But let's turn to the federal courts, which receive less attention, but are also a terrible legacy of the Trump administration that's going to live with us for a long time. These are also, as I understand it, basically lifetime appointments. You have experience with the federal court through death penalty appeals. Can you take us through the appeal process and the role of federal courts through death penalty appeals? And of course, the Trump administration carried out it, I believe it's its 9th federal execution of the year last week, and plans some further executions.
It's a total bloodbath. The federal system right now. These are people convicted of federal crimes, and it's just a rampant murders of people who've got really excellent claims, people who are intellectually disabled. Yesterday, a man who was 18 years old and not a direct perpetrator of a crime was killed. It's just a bloodbath. There's no other phrase for it. The way things work generally, the idea of federal court is to oversee state courts who get caught up in political heat of the moment. And the federal judges are appointed for life, and they get one review. In theory, you have a trial. It's all done by a county. There's a review, an appeal, and then there's a Supreme Court within the state. And if you lose those, then you can go to the federal system, go to the federal district court, present claims. If you lose that, you can go to one of the circuits, like the Ninth Circuit governs over Oregon. And if you lose that, you can go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So would you say the system of appeals in principle is progressive?
Yeah, it's the idea is federal oversight. It was essential, and it was created after the Civil War, when killing a black person was barely a misdemeanor in Mississippi, and there was no way that African Americans could obtain any sort of judicial review or even a fair trial. And the federal system was aimed to be a replacement where states were unwilling or unable because of general politics of the moment, a particularly inflammatory case, or because of just systemic prejudice, unable to uphold the Constitution. So that's the theory. And of course, in practice, it varies widely. And there are terrific federal judges who will look carefully at what any defendant writes and sends to them. There's a lot of really bad ones. And now with Trump, of course, the numbers of bad ones, of barely literate judges, has exponentially increased.
Do they have a different role in various regions or jurisdictions of the country where you might want to defend them or turn to them more in some regions than others?
The overall message is that we should avoid the courts and not rely on the courts nearly to the extent that progressive people have. We should recognize the Supreme Court is a bastion of reactionary rulings and will be for the foreseeable future, that we need to concentrate on local elections. There is a remarkably progressive district attorneys who have been elected all around the country. They have real power. They make the initial choices about what is a crime and what's not a crime and what to prosecute. We need good state legislators. We need good mayors. We need to focus on the democratic process in every way that we can and not rely on courts to save our bacon.
Okay, well, Mike, we'll continue to follow the news around the courts, and next month we'll also take up the dangers and perils and possibilities around the Supreme Court and Roe v. Wade and the reproductive justice movement. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the Trump legacy and the courts.